Like many people, I've been thinking a lot about Anthony Bourdain and the epidemic of suicides occurring. You know, they're actually increasing. And so it's so I'm not sure where I'll go with that tonight, but I wanted to give some voice and some almost like a prayer or something for the spirit of Anthony Bourdain, someone who gave so much to humanity through his exposing people to the world of other countries and cultures, of course through the medium of food and travel. And I think that you know, it's impossible to understand completely whatever that enormity of pain, misery can cause someone to seek relief in the form of suicide, to the depth of that kind of pain. But it did make me think about a few things, and so I wanted to share some stray thoughts tonight. And I hope it's, even though I dropped in the word suicide and whatever associations you have or pain, I also can't help but continue to have a sense of humor. And so I had my funny bone was struck a little bit tonight when I was thinking about how I might talk about my stray thoughts. And my first thought tonight was the words of one of my dear friends. His name is Ron Stark. Maybe some of you have, over the years, over the last 35 years or so, being involved in the Dharma scene, he used to advertise his dental practice in the Inquiring Mind Journal. And it was his advertisement had a picture of him as a young cherubic boy, and he would say some kind of pithy thing to encourage people to call him, and he otherwise known as the Dharma dentist. But he also, his last name is Stark, and he was also, over the course of his life, he's been a stand-up comic and has he shares what he calls stark reality. And the number one passage in stark reality is, if you don't know the Dharma, you don't know shit. And so that went through my mind. It seems a little incongruent with the time, but it went through my mind. And so I thought I would start with that, because I think it's actually true. If you don't have, and when he says the Dharma, it means an understanding of the way of life, the way of nature, how things actually are. And what the Buddha taught, and what Buddhas know the Dharma. Buddhas know the way things are. And the way one of my teachers, Ajahn Sumedho, put it, the only difference between a Buddha and an ordinary person is a Buddha knows whatever arises passes away. That's what Buddhas know. And that's the only thing, really fundamental thing, that makes them different from ordinary human beings. Buddha, and when I say Buddhas means one who is awake to the way things are. So we all touch into being awake to the way things are. So we all have Buddha nature. We all have a part of us that's wise, that is loving, that sees clearly, that is in some way, because of the clarity of perception, we're untouched by what happens to us. We're in harmony with it. We're not so reactive to life because we understand it. There's a place in us. But we also forget. We have Buddha nature, but we also have what's called ignorant nature. We have the nature to be deluded and not see clearly. And as a culture, and I don't want to generalize too much, but as a culture, we are inculcated from the time we're born with some avidya, with some ignorance, some delusion. And the number one delusion is that we think that in the world of conditions being the way they are, that somewhere in there, there is an experience of happiness that is unbroken. There is an experience that you can have of an unbroken happiness, of a happiness that just goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Now, how does that square with what the Buddha knows? The Buddha knows that whatever arises passes away. Remember, the Buddha's guru was impermanence. So, does any state, have you ever found any state in your life that has been constant? Have you ever been continuously happy? Anybody here? Oh. Any state that arises has the nature to pass away. Yet, even in so-called spiritual circles, there is this hunt, there is this search for the state that never goes away, the great happiness beyond sorrow. But the funny thing is that the secret to the highest possible happiness that we can have as a human, the secret to being a Buddha, is to know there's no steady state. Whatever arises passes away. Without this knowledge, this what's called wise view, whatever is born dies, whatever arises fades, whatever praise is followed by blame, whatever is gained is followed by loss, whatever is pleasurable followed by pain. Because of this basic misperception, this view that there is a solid, that there is a possibility of some kind of continuous happiness, our human condition, and I think especially in our culture, the engine being this misperception, there is a constant search for pleasure, associating whatever we hope is that permanent state of happiness, the highest happiness, associating it with the acquisition of experiences that will make us happy. And as much as I have, again, I have no idea all of the ins and outs of Anthony Bourdain's heart and mind, all I can feel really is just sad. And I really can't even speak to any kind of absolute truth about suicide. I don't know about suicide, to tell you the truth. You know, we can make up all kinds of belief systems about it. I can tell you what the teachings say about it, that it's killing, and it's the taking of life. It's breaking of the most central precept in the Buddha's teaching, that it causes harm. Of course, the assumption is that if you believe in the cosmology, that you'll take birth in whatever that state of aversion to life that drove that decision, and it just keeps you going on the wheel of suffering. Maybe some momentary relief, but not only that, but the impact of the suffering caused to others who loved you or cared for you or just who are heartsick over that. And there's so much ripple effect of that kind of act. But forgetting that for a moment, getting back to that cultural trance, that association of happiness with seeking pleasure and experience, Anthony Bourdain was the poster person for the happiness and joy that comes from eating well and traveling. And so many people aspire to that kind of life, and there's nothing wrong with travel and food and a wide range of food and having many beautiful experiences. But if you don't understand that what arises passes away, you're likely to, each of us in our own way in our life, are likely to just unconsciously, because of this systemic trance, we are likely to put what the Buddha called misplaced faith in experiences of the senses. Anthony Bourdain said things like, eating this beautiful green salad, they keep redoing this video over and over. This is the secret to the wisdom and happiness as he's eating this green salad. But then in more revealing moments, and you probably saw this if you were pulled into following the story of his passing, one of the episodes, he's in the therapist's office and he's saying, I can eat a burger that's not so good, and then I will spiral down into a depression for days over a burger. Now, of course, that speaks to a groundlessness that I could probably interpret psychologically as some place in the span of his developmental psychology, he didn't have good holding. The ground fell. And for all of us, there were probably some perceived moments of lack that we then froze and then spend our life looking for someone or something to relieve that feeling of emptiness that comes when there's nothing there. As we probably all had a moment where we needed to be held or loved or something when we were little, and our parents were busy doing something and they just couldn't be there for us. So we carry often psychological feelings of groundlessness, of emptiness, and find so myriad ways of filling that with a distraction or pleasure, something that will make us not have to feel so desperately empty. Of course, the Dharma, practice of Dharma, as we touch into the emptiness of any moment of being truly present, the openness of this moment after your last thought has stopped and before the next one comes, there's often a space, a gap. And when that gap becomes more palpable when you train your attention to live in the present moment, using whatever presents itself to guide you here, sounds and sights and smells and tastes. When you experience them intimately, they and your mind meets them with mindful attention, your mind stops elaborating, stops thinking about, stops analyzing, stops interpreting, stops pushing, stops pulling, and it just lays bare the experience that's happening just as it is. And that bare attention often then reveals a quality, a call to the nature of awareness itself, of knowing, of being conscious, that is completely empty, simple, beautiful, full of everything. The source and the cause of love and intelligence and everything right here. But when our mind is untrained, undeveloped, and we experience that gap, we go, ah, get me out of here. This is scary. And at first, when people start to have this experience in meditation, they get really freaked out, and they have what's called the rolling up the mat phase, where you want to roll up your mat and go home because it seems to. But the more you practice, the more you just get used to this natural openness and love that's really completely organic and natural to us and safe. And we find a degree of safety just being present. But if my way of dealing with that psychological openness is not developing my mind and training my attention to be present, if instead it is in seeking experience, trying to fill the holes with people, with things, with situations, then every time that emptiness occurs again, I freak out. And what do I do when I freak out? I have to keep filling it more. And that's what we call addiction. Addictive mind just keeps seeking, not recognizing, having put misplaced faith in the objects of our desire, experiencing the momentary pleasure of having filled that hole of distraction with distraction, but that pleasure lasting a few moments and leaving in its wake a feeling of loss again. And then out of love for ourselves, filling it up again. And so if you don't know the Dharma, you think that some experience of your senses, some place that you go, some person that you're with, will actually permanently fill that void. And that void is not meant to be filled. It is meant to be filled, but it's meant to be filled with wisdom, with attention, with understanding, with the understanding that whatever arises fades away. So guided by that understanding of whatever arises fades away, where does one place their attention? Where does one find a reliable refuge? How does one soothe one's heart from that feeling of being unsafe or empty or sad or desperate? What does one do with that? So what the Dharma, the teachings say, is you fill it with loving kindness, self-compassion. I haven't read this in quite a while, but I just think it's, well, maybe I have and I'm having a senior moment. And this may seem like it's off topic, but just hang in there with me. A man observed a woman in the grocery store with a 3-year-old girl in her basket. As they passed the cookie section, the little girl asked for cookies, and her mother told her no. The little girl immediately began to whine and fuss, and the mother said quietly, "Now, Monica, we just have half the aisles left to go through, so don't be upset. It won't be long." Soon they came to the candy aisle, and the little girl began to shout for candy, and when told she couldn't have any, began to cry. The mother said, "There, there, Monica, don't cry. Only 2 more aisles to go, and then we'll be checking out." When they got to the checkout stand, the little girl immediately began to clamor for gum and burst into a terrible tantrum upon discovering there would be no gum purchased. The mother patiently said, "Monica, we'll be through the checkout stand in 5 minutes, then you can go home and have a nice nap." A man followed them out to the parking lot and stopped the woman to compliment her. "I couldn't help noticing how patient you were with little Monica," he began, whereupon the mother said, "I'm Monica. My little girl's name is Tammy." And that's the spirit. That's the spirit of self-soothing, self-care. And it may sound trite in the face of the tremendous misery that would cause someone to take one's own life, but it's a message that that even though the methodology that we use to soothe ourselves, it really is to soothe ourselves. It just the methodology of self-harm is not. It doesn't make anyone happy. The methodology of self-harm, of self-judgment, of pushing, forcing, scolding, or at its extreme, the extreme version of self-harm, it doesn't do the trick, and leaves in its wake so much more suffering. So I also was thinking during the sitting tonight about, and part of the reason I spoke of the systemic ignorance, the systemic tendency, I was thinking about the teacher named Maladoma Somei, who part of this tribe in Africa. He's anthropologist, spiritual teacher, etc. But he was part of the Dogara tribe. And the Dogara tribe, when someone is acting out really intensely, who's really miserable or screaming or making trouble in the community, the whole community gathers around that person. And they talk to that person about their lives and all the wonderful things they've done, and they basically have a several-day celebration. And they have the understanding that when someone is acting out, they're actually giving voice to something that the whole community needs to hear. That it's actually not just the individual. And our tendency, especially in our individualistic culture where we tend to both isolate and self-blame, we don't realize that so much of what we've been essentially colonized by certain cultural views and values. And they are values and views. One of them is that shop till you drop as a means of happiness, or travel till you can't, or try every variety of food as a source of happiness. It hasn't made anybody happy. And I can't say that any of the emptiness of all this led to Anthony Bourdain's suicide. But maybe somewhere along the line he realized the emptiness of that, of seeking pleasure through conditions that don't last. So to me, his passing is a teaching that yes, we all long to be happy, but there is no steady state that one can find through the continual acquisition of experience. But that an interesting result of really seeing that clearly, to be really in harmony with that fact that things arise and pass away, one finds a certain harmony, a certain peace. A peace that's not created, that's not just a mood, moods all come and go, but a peace that knows, a peace that arises from knowing. Peace that arises from wisdom, from wise view, that everything that is born dies. And that's what Buddhas know. So if you don't know that, you don't know manure. So the manure of the fertilizer of awakening is to see with clarity. Remember, ignorance, lack of clear perception of reality is the source of all of our cravings, all of our ill will, all of our delusion. And so it is wisdom, it's clarity of perception that cuts to the root of what causes us suffering. And I wish that we could all be truly free of delusion. And then the effects of delusion are the second noble truth, greed in the mind, and hatred, which is just the flip side. And in the Buddha's teaching, the second noble truth, the cause of our continued stress and suffering is the quality, it's called tanha, is craving. Craving for sense pleasures, craving for becoming, always going. Looking for that experience that will assure our permanence. And then the flip side of that is craving for non-becoming. It's, one's called bhava, the other's called abhava tanha, which is the craving to make it all stop. And unfortunately, the culmination of that is some version of self-harm. And the culmination of the craving for becoming is this chronic feeling of dissatisfaction. To see, to understand that craving for what's next, obsessing about what's next, going leads to suffering. If we see that, then something in us lets go. And letting go is the reminder that there's an end to this constant search. And the path of mindful attention, wise action, wise livelihood, wise understanding, with mindfulness as the navigator, can lead us to this cessation of craving. Lead us right back to where we are already. I think of the teachings of Sri Nisargadatta where he says, all search for happiness is misery and leads to more misery. The only happiness worth that name is the natural happiness of being conscious, being awake, being clear in our perception. He says, nothing can make you happier than you are fundamentally. Try that on for a moment. All search for happiness is misery. So just for a moment, don't look ahead, don't look back. Call off the search, as my teacher used to say. And see if in real time anything is lacking. And if you recognize the natural peace and ease that is the natural peace of your own mind, get used to it. Get used to it. Don't stray away from it. And then as the pleasures come and the pleasures go, you'll remain at ease. Whatever arises passes away, and that's what Buddhas know. Stephen.
Seeking this space of happiness.
Wait, could you take the mic? Would you take the microphone so everyone can hear your question, and then this will be our last dialogue for the night. Do you mind? Thank you, Stephen. It is. I don't think it's turned on.
Thank you. In the practice, when something like this happens, I mean, on one hand, you put a lot of emphasis on what might have been going on, or by implication that he was seeking and not finding, and that was my sense of him, that he was always in search. And higher.
Close to your mouth, please.
Okay. This is an education.
Seemed like he was seeking and not finding.
Yes, seeking and not finding, and maybe some despair about not finding led him that way. I only heard one thing where he once said that the most important thing to him in his life was, that made him feel most good, was picking up his daughter after school, and which I found kind of touching. But
yeah.
But the real question I'm asking is there something in practice when something like this happens to somebody, a way of extending compassion?
Yeah, well, that was how I was going to end tonight. Thank you for bringing that in.
I didn't want you to forget in a senior moment.
Thank you. So I did want to, you know, first of all, just share some stray thoughts that I was having about the culture of seeking, the culture of craving, the culture of seeking and not finding. And also just to express, you know, my feeling of loss, you know, and I imagine others have felt the same thing. There's brought a lot of joy and resonance. I felt like he was a kindred spirit in a certain way. But when someone, I don't know what happens when someone dies, and what I was about to share was something that I borrow from the Tibetan tradition, that at least their view is that when someone dies, they go through a process where they are what are called bardos, where they go into different states of experience. They're revisited by things that have happened, different visions, different desires, that basically whatever habits that they've practiced, they are visited, and they are, as anyone is, they're given an opportunity at the time of passing to either merge with the great light of life, to enter into life, to just die into life and merge with what's called the clear light. Or when the visions that come, that person has to navigate, and the past experiences and past karma visits, the opportunity is to see that all of those visions are inseparable from that clear light, that person's natural state that we've talked about, that fundamental sense that I'm beyond anything, beyond my identity, I'm conscious. Beyond my name, beyond my form, I'm conscious. So one can realize that more vividly when one dies. And one can see that whatever those visions are just made of that same clear light. And the idea is to see that and just keep remembering the light. So we would want for him and anyone who's passed, we'd want them to remember the clear light, the shining light of our fundamental nature, that which lives in you and lives inside of me, the light of consciousness. Invisible, yet allows everything to be known. If he can recognize the clear light and not be caught up in the visions that visit him during this transition period, he can be liberated. So let's wish that for him. May Anthony Bourdain be liberated and remember the clear light, the bright light of his own nature, and recognize that that's deathless, that that's beyond birth and death. But also warn him that if he follows all the visions that come through his mind, all those memories, all those ideas, he could wander a long time confused. And those visions, if you follow them, will determine future rebirths, where he'll end up. Again, who knows whether this is true? But there is, if it resonates with you, then maybe possible. But it's really it's also a teaching to all of us as we go through our days, that we have our own birth and death every moment. And when we follow the visions in our mind, all the thoughts, all the mistaken views about ourselves, and we follow them, we wander around confused. We forget ourselves. We forget what our real medicine is. So along with Anthony Bourdain, we want to remember the clear light. Remember to be aware. Remember not to get caught up in what our mind is saying anytime. So let's all together both wish him well, wish ourselves well, and wish that we remember the clear light, that it's deathless. And may we all be liberated. May he be liberated. May he have a safe and peaceful transition. And may our practice tonight and our life be dedicated to the awakening of all beings, including Anthony Bourdain. May he be liberated. Anyway, thanks for letting me share my stray thoughts, and sorry for all of our loss. And thank you so much.